Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia with ease, travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk, and take away the guesswork that goes along with converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
The Green New Deal has been one of the hottest policy topics all year. We haven't had that much of a chance to dive into it here on The Weeds, so I was really excited to sit down with Julian Noisecat, who runs the Green New Deal program at Data for Progress. We talked about a lot of aspects of this sort of big concept on politics and policy. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today is Julian Noisecat. He is the director of Green New Deal program at Data for Progress.
Yes.
That's fantastic. This is a subject people have been asking about, Green New Deal. So I'm going to start. We'd like to start with a big, dumb question at Vox, but I'm going to get like so dumb. Like what is a Green New Deal?
So the Green New Deal is a progressive climate policy vision to take on the twin crises of climate change and inequality in tandem.
So let's cash that out a little bit, right? So it's like, why pair climate change with inequality? I mean, inequality is important. There are many important questions, though.
Yeah, absolutely. So the reason why we believe it is essential to take on these issues together is that in order to tackle climate change, we're going to have to invest in a major way in our energy sector, in transportation, in buildings, agriculture, manufacturing, and that those investments, the way in which we go about that transition to a decarbonized economy, needs to take into account the existing inequities in the economy. Questions about where these investments will go, which communities will benefit, are really essential. They're essential to all sorts of policy, whether you talk about housing, manufacturing, et cetera. Also, who those jobs will go to, right, are really essential questions. And, you know, to be real, the transition to a low carbon or no carbon economy is also going to require significant shifts in the way in which we do things, most chiefly in the fossil fuel economy and the adjacent industries. And we need to make sure that we are taking care of the people who worked in those industries and also the communities that were polluted by those industries.
I mean, just set up like a broad contrast, right? If you're old like me out there and you remember in the mid-aughts, George W. Bush was president. Nothing was happening on climate change. But there was a lot of talk. You know, John McCain was interested in the climate issue. He was running for president. And there was like a bipartisan process that was sort of built around him, built around Lindsey Graham, and built around the idea of a cap and trade or a carbon tax, right? So this is like, you know, economics 101, how do you deal with pollution? You charge a fee for the externalities. And then, you know, the idea to get Republican buy-in, at least the idea of the bipartisan process was, look, this is going to be sort of minimal beyond that, right? Like we are going to charge for the externalities and then we are going to take that money and either offset other taxes or give it to people in a kind of lump sum and then we'll just like let the market operate. And the Green New Deal is the, I don't want to say it's the opposite of that because like the opposite is do nothing, but it's a sharply contrasting vision.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you know, it, not so long ago, when I was a younger person, it was possible, you know, Bush 1 talked about fighting the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. You know, McCain also supported some cap and trade policies. And, you know, I think that the way in which Washington in particular thought about this issue began from the point of bipartisan compromise, bipartisan. And, you know, there's I almost like to think of the sort of climate wonks of this generation as a little bit parakeetish. You know, you ask them about climate change and they said, carbon tax, you know, or something like that. And obviously, the politics have shifted mm-hmm. in a decade since then. You know, your colleague Ezra Klein has done a lot of great podcasts about polarization and the ways in which that is impacting our politics. And I think that, you know, the real political difference between the Green New Deal approach and, you know, a carbon price or carbon tax or a cap and trade approach is that instead of beginning from, you know, what is what we can get, you know, the most moderate Republican, like, say, Susan Collins, on board with in terms of climate policy. But instead, you know, what would be a full-throated Democratic approach to this problem? What would be the way in which we can approach this as progressives that can build not just, you know, sort of consensus in the Beltway, but also a broad sort of social movement that can win on the issue? Because one of the big sort of takeaways from the failure of Waxman-Markey, of course, passed in the House, never came to the Senate floor for a vote, was that there was not that sustained outside social movement presence to push for climate policy at the time. And I think that one of the key insights and exciting developments of a Green New Deal is that we're actually starting to build that. We're starting to build the kind of movement that can, when it comes crunch time, you know, take to Capitol Hill and put pressure on our elected officials to make sure that we get climate legislation across the finish line.
So that means sort of working with the, I mean, if the vision of the pricing focus was sort of work with the elements of the business community and the conservative movement that are most open to addressing climate change and find a way that's acceptable to them. And the Green New Deal approach is say, look, like work with the communities that anchor the progressive movement and see what they require out of this kind of plan.
Yes, I think that's totally right in terms of the sort of political shift, which is a significant political shift. I think that there's just and as while we talk through the politics, there's also a question here about you know, why begin with compromise position? Why not just begin with what we believe and what we want, and then sort of compromise from there? I think that there's a lot of sort of sense to that sort of theory of the game. And then I think there's also, you know, there's been a decade now since the cap and trade conversation. Emissions got a Trump bump in 2018. The Rhodium Group has done some really great sort of analysis of this. And the situation is therefore much, much more dire. And the actions that we have to take from a scientific perspective in order to limit warming to 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius are much more drastic. And actually, just this month, there was a very interesting paper in the National Bureau of Economic Research that basically made the argument that a carbon price would have to be in the hundreds of dollars per ton figure in order to actually get the kind of emissions reductions that we need. So I think at the same time as the political currents have changed, the science has become more apparent, the problem has languished, and therefore the actions that need to be taken have grown. And I think that there's growing sort of consensus, particularly among Green New Deal advocates, but I'd say also more broadly speaking, that a carbon tax, a price on carbon, is not going to be sufficient to achieve the emissions reductions.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, I wrote up, this is a few years ago for Vox, but it was about a water pricing plan that had happened in North Carolina. It was supposed to, you know, address water shortages in a sort of classic textbook economics-y way. But what the researchers found, you know, was that pricing intersects with inequality in an interesting way, right? That if you draw up a model in which most people have about the same economic resources, then in response to a price, people shift their consumption based on, essentially based on tastes. And that's sort of how it's supposed to work in a model, right? It's like the people who don't really care, right? The people who don't mind the temperature being, you know, a little bit cooler in the winter, just like don't heat their house quite as much. And there's lots of small adjustments. But in the context of severe inequality, then people's response to a price signal is driven by their economic resources, right? And so you require a very high price to make a very drastic change in behavior. But then how people can adapt just has a lot to do with how much money they have, right? So these subjects really kind of do pair up. But so then in terms of the Green New Deal strategy, I mean, what so is
it? Can I just actually comment on that point? That I think that point is really important, what you just pointed out. And the paper that I just referred to, they mentioned that initially the carbon price, like 70% of that cost would be borne by the consumer.
Right.
And that is fundamentally, I would say, an inequitable and regressive kind of tax, right? Ultimately, I believe we want the corporations to be, you know, who have contributed most to this crisis to be the ones who are contributing to our, you know, pile of government revenue to take it on. But in fact, it's going to be, you know, ratepayers. It's going to be, you know, folks who have to drive long commutes to get to their work site every day that are going to bear that cost. And there have been real already political backlash to this, right? The Yellow Vest movement in France was in large part a response to Macron's carbon tax scheme. So I think that in terms of questions of equity and who should be paying for this crisis, I think that the carbon pricing approach has really failed to take hold and be effective globally.
And Macron, I mean, I feel like this was not always conveyed clearly in the U.S. coverage, but his sort of carbon tax charge was in the context of an overall set of regressive tax changes in France, where he was trying to bring down topping up tax levels, right? So you can imagine, like, there are many different ways to configure this and have an overall kind of package. But, you know, what he was doing was very much a regressive tax shift, which, you know, I think could have been maybe the basis for a bipartisan deal at some point, but clearly, you know, hasn't been in the United States. So what, I mean, if not this heavy emphasis on pricing, I mean, what is the Green New Deal approach? What do we do specifically?
So I'm not quite as forceful in saying that carbon pricing can't be part of the policy mix. Mm-hmm. I think there's a strong case that particular sectors' prices actually makes a lot of sense in terms of the way that you'd approach decarbonizing. But I would say that the major sort of policy and intellectual shift that the Green New Deal marks in terms of discussion about mechanisms is firstly a conversation that begins on investment. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the Green New Deal, obviously there's a lot of conversation about like how many dollars of public spending are going to go into the economy. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez threw out a $10 trillion figure not so long ago. It's a lot of money. You know, Jay Inslee has, I think, $3 trillion committed in public funding, which then leverages towards $10 trillion, or I think maybe $8 trillion actually. And so I think that conversation about investment is first and foremost a major one. And I think to just pause on that for a second, that marks a significant change, I would say, in terms of the way in which this country approaches environmental policy. Mm-hmm. I think we've had a very regulatory heavy approach throughout our history and sort of shifting towards major public investment as the way in which we tackle ecological environmental challenges is a major shift. I think the second is also an increasing interest in mandates. So this is like renewable portfolio mm-hmm. standards, clean electricity standards. These would basically be policies that mandate a scheduled sort of increase in clean and renewable energy sources on the grid by a particular sort of date. So the most common ones that get talked about are 2050 nationally, maybe 2045 in the Inslee plan, 2035 in the Inslee plan. We talked about 2035 in our Data for Progress blueprint for a Green New Deal.
So how does that work? So it's like we have, what do we get our electricity from? Exelon here in DC. And you say to them, okay, now it's 2021. Over the next 15 years, you need to get 100% of your electricity from renewable sources.
Yep.
And then it's up to them. Probably that does mean higher prices, but it's like the mandate is just placed on them.
Yeah, the mandate is placed on the provider. And then I think there's also a significant debate about definitions of clean and renewable electricity that are probably lost on most sort of observers of this, but this is also a really important thing.
I want to get into that later. But my question about these sort of clean energy mandates is always, when you make them really ambitious, how do you make sure that it actually happens? You know, it's like if you tell an electrical utility you have to increase your purchases of whatever it is, like solar power, by some tiny amount, then you figure, okay, they'll go and do it, right? They may not like it, but it is what it is. But if you're saying, look, you've got to get all of the dirty energy off your grid on a 20-year timetable, that's a tough bill. And what if they just don't?
Yeah, I mean, I think that then you get into a question of like financial sticks and legal carrots, right? Mm-hmm. What are the? I think you need to make sure that the penalties for not meeting those targets are enough that you know they don't just blow you off,
right?
You know, and I think you also need to have the sort of the direction of public spending into these energy sources to ensure that they get to cost, mm-hmm. You know, as soon as possible. And then I think also this is where some folks might say that a carbon price would actually be a helpful addition to the mix.
So on this, like, the federal government doesn't, generally speaking, like, own electricity generating facilities, right? So if you say, okay, well, we need more investment in roads, you know, it's like, I know what that means. There's a highway trust fund. You can put more money in it. You say, we need another aircraft carrier. Like, we have a program that does that. When we talk about, okay, we're going to make more public investments in creating clean electricity. Like, what does that look like? Sort of on the ground?
I mean, what that looks like on the ground is, you know, I mean, I think the first thing that people will think about is installing solar on their homes. And I think that is, you know, a very achievable, real, and powerful solution. I think it also shifts the balance of power away from the utility, which is often a monopoly, and back towards the consumer. And there's actually a lot of places wherein the consumers can then sell their energy back to the grid and can be quite empowering for people against sort of the broader systems in which they're in. I think also what it looks like is, so you asked about like, so what the build out of clean and renewable energy looks like. You know, I think it also, so it looks like jobs. You know, I think that the clean and renewable energy sectors are some of the fastest growing in the country. You know, there's immense opportunity for sort of skilling up workers for those industries, for working class people to get jobs, you know, building wind turbines. These can also often be union jobs, I think it's really important to point out. So, you know, the building trades, particularly in the Northeast, have been very interested in offshore wind projects. And this can also be a major boon to some of these economies. So like a state like Rhode Island, for example, could actually be a net energy exporter if you develop
Because it's so windy,
yeah. And so you know, people talk about 100% energy as you know, like a very difficult target to reach. But actually, there are some places where maybe it could be 150%, and that 50% is going, you know, to Vermont or something like that, mm-hmm. right?
So still, in terms of like, so we're going to do it, right? So the federal government is going to finance the construction of offshore wind in Rhode Island, or I don't know, I guess like utility scale solar, probably someplace where it's sunnier. But like, who gets the plant? Is this like a funding that goes through electrical utilities and they go get it? It's money to states to go do things. The federal government is going to start owning power plants. I mean, I guess the federal government owns Tennessee Valley Authority, mm-hmm. so we could do that everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. One piece of this that I think is really important is that there's an assumption, I would say, from sort of more moderate Democrats that the Green New Deal is secretly just a plan to nationalize everything and to sort of shift towards democratic socialism. I actually think that, you know, my colleague Brianna Gunn-Wright has talked about public-private partnerships as being part mm-hmm. of the approach. I think that the way in which we actualize a lot of this stuff is still very much up for debate. I think also in the same way that the original New Deal sort of embraced an experimental sort of vision of policy, you know, throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's a lot that we will be learning very soon from the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in New York State, which is a big climate law that was passed there. I think there's lessons to be learned from California, where they've done a mix of cap and trade and investment and renewable portfolio standards. There's also a law in the books now in Washington State. And so I think that there's a lot of different ways in which we can think about actualizing this that would include, you know, public investment, would obviously include private investment that public investment leverages, and also, you know, empowers different actors throughout our sort of federal system. So it might sometimes be the federal government, it might sometimes be state or local governments, it might sometimes be private utilities. And I think that, you know, quite often we also are going to want to ensure that unions, you know, who have really been battered over the last sort of 30 years of economic and labor policy are key stakeholders at the table. And I think that's where you bring in things like offshore wind, utility scale solar. And actually, I think here scale, like, you know, going big is the kind of thing that that can get those players particularly excited.
All right, let's take a break here. I want to come back to that New York law because it's a good blueprint.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise might just be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, sending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account could work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com, Wise.com.
So you mentioned just before that New York State has recently passed a sort of big climate law that is a kind of a state level Green New Deal, or at least Green New Deal inspired.
So the advocates of it would be a little bit more hesitant to call it a state level Green New Deal for very intra-left political reasons. But for our intents and purposes, I would say that this is a great example of how we can do progressive climate legislation.
And so that means it has a coalition behind it that is environmentalists, but also labor, also
yes, so
racial justice groups.
Right, right. So there was a group called New York Renews that led the campaign for CLCPA, the pop star formerly known as CCPA. And what they did over 4 years is, after one of the People's Climate Marches, they created a table to discuss what climate policy might look like in New York State. They included environmental justice communities. So these are communities of color on the front lines of pollution, labor unions, and green groups as part of that coalition. And they started developing sort of a policy approach to climate that centered issues of justice. So key to CLCPA is investments in communities of color. 40% of the investments go to communities of color. They were pushing for project labor agreements as part of the CLCPA. Those ended up getting watered down and taken out by Governor Cuomo, unfortunately. But it was really that sort of approach to climate where you know, communities could not just benefit from sort of emissions reductions, but also investments in infrastructure in their community, jobs coming to their community, that ended up actually building a successful legislative coalition such that, you know, when 2018 rolled around and the Senate in New York State flipped, or not exactly flipped, but we got the independent Democrat.
Yes, it was a complicated thing.
Complicated thing. But anyways, that it became possible to achieve this kind of climate legislation, which I think many advocates and experts would say is one of the strongest climate bills ever enacted in the world.
So what is the labor piece of this exactly? Because perennially a sort of problem for environmental causes is that, you know, you have in the United States labor unions that are a little bit tenuous, right? So in some countries, you know, if you go to Finland, right, like every large employer is basically covered by a collective bargaining agreement. So if you put forward an economic change that like puts some companies out of business, but then there's some different companies, people are still unionized. That's like baked into the cake, right? But America's not like that, right? So if jobs disappear in particular unionized sectors, even if some new employment opportunity exists, right, like that is still a blow to labor. And so it gets very tricky often to talk about large scale economic change. So like what's the mechanism to kind of square that circle?
I think one of the most often cited cleavages in Democratic politics is this environment versus jobs and unions sort of narrative. At Data for Progress, I should say that we have analyzed our own public opinion survey data on this issue and actually found that the story is a little bit overblown. So the union members who responded to our surveys were actually union membership was one of the most highly correlated identifiers that could determine your support for a Green New Deal.
Should also say, of course, I mean, the biggest labor union in America right now is teachers union, right?
Yeah.
I mean, a very large share of the union workforce is in service sectors, is in public sectors, particularly in education. A lot of the organizing is in, you know, digital media outlets like here. So, yeah, I mean, I do think it's important to not like overly dwell on like a 1970s vision of like what the union labor force is in America. But it's still true, right? Like when people were campaigning against Keystone Pipeline,
yeah,
right? There were people from the building trades who were like, no, like we want to build the pipeline. That's what we do here.
Yeah, I mean, so LIUNA put out a press release around Dakota Access calling a number of my friends who were working on the campaign at Standing Rock thugs. So yes, this is it does exist. I just want to foreground what I'm saying with,
yeah, no, I agree.
It's a little bit overblown, I would say. SEIU, which is also one of the biggest unions, obviously, in the country, just came out in favor of the Green New Deal. So I think we're making major inroads with labor. But the basic issue is that there are a number of unions, particularly the building trades, boilermakers, you know, mine workers, who work in fossil fuel industries or fossil fuel adjacent industries. Those jobs, truthfully, tend to be actually quite high-paying jobs. So if you have a high school diploma, it's possible to make a six-figure salary if you're working in some of these industries. And truthfully, the way in which we have, in the places that we have enacted a transition. It has not been particularly friendly to those workers. So they will often look at companies like Tesla, for example, which has a pretty anti-union stance, and say, well, if this is what, you know, clean energy looks like, I don't think I'm super interested in that. And this is one of the big, big challenges that I would say advocates for a Green New Deal face. You know, we need to ensure that in the transition to a clean and renewable energy economy that we are taking care of those workers. I mean, and I think here again, scale is actually in some ways our friend.
How does that work?
So Governor Inslee in particular, and we've worked with him on a number of his platforms, has talked about a GI Bill for fossil fuel workers. So, you know, traditionally the conversation used to be about like, you know, job retraining and that sort of smaller ball type stuff. You know, we are very interested in things like a federal job guarantee as as being part of the conversation, ensuring every American has access to a job. You know, I think in something like a GI Bill for fossil fuel workers, I think, you know, sort of supporting them in the same way that we supported veterans of World War II when they came home, you know, ensuring that they can transition to another good paying job, another union job, and ensuring, you know, through things like the development of utility scale solar, offshore wind, these types of sort of clean and renewable energy developments that are more favorable to union organizing, more centralized. I think that there is potential to get some of the more oppositional unions on board. And I think this is actually being borne out in places like New York. In New York, there is just a plan for a large offshore wind project. And the building trades, which are the same sort of set of unions that said not nice things about my friends at Standing Rock, you know, are on board with that kind of a development. And so I think that those types of, at the same time as there is obviously going to be some opposition as we phase out fossil fuels, which is what we have to do, I think that there will be opportunities to bring some of the major unions to the table.
And that's sort of a difference between when you're saying no to things, you have some group of stakeholders who are like, yeah, but we want to build that. Right. Versus if you have a dynamic that's about doing things, right, like you're building new stuff, then you have sort of more things you can give away. Right. I mean, there's more jobs to be created. There's more things people can get on board about. Right. And I think that's an important part of the sort of flip here, right, is that if we're talking about constraining the fossil fuel economy, that generates a lot of, you know, intense losers, right? Some of whom may be like incredibly unsympathetic coal barons, but a lot of whom are like pretty normal people, just like they're doing jobs, right? But if you're talking about, okay, well, we're going to like build this and that and the other thing, then you have something people can kind of say yes to and embrace.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that for a long time, we framed climate policy in terms of these trade-offs and this sort of issue of scarcity. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that the Green New Deal is aiming to do is to do exactly what you just pointed out, which is portray this transition as an opportunity, one where, you know, unions, communities of color, you know, people across America can you know, win out.
So can we talk about some of the sort of internal disagreements and nuances here? You wrote a great document about this that's up on the Data for Progress site. But I think like one big one is that if you read candidates' plans, I don't specialize in this, but I like to read plans. And so some people talk about—
You are unique probably in that way.
Renewable energy. And some people talk about zero carbon energy.
Yes. So firstly, I just want to say that the Green New Deal conversation actually has— created more opportunities for convergence, I would say, than divergence. Mm-hmm. But that there are real issues that various constituencies have different stances on that are going to matter as we sort of sort out how we would go about actually enacting a Green New Deal. So I wrote a document. It's a 15-page memo called An Insider's Guide to the Climate Debate. It includes, and we try to keep it updated every few weeks.
If you listen to a podcast called The Weeds, like you were really going to enjoy enjoy this memo.
It's I think it's a pretty cool product. It outlines sort of 15 issue areas in sort of the Green New Deal curious community, and then sort of arguments on different sides of each. So some of them have two arguments, some have four, and tries to sort of, you know, outlined the choices that we face, and hopefully in reading through that, help people actually get to a synthesis. I do believe in sort of the Hegelian view of arguments, wherein, you know, A, B gets us to C, but I don't know, sometimes it feels like A, B gets us to zero.
Right.
So on the clean versus renewable, so this is a question, of definitions, essentially. So renewable energy is usually defined as like wind, solar, geothermal. Sometimes people will include biomass. I don't really think so biomass is basically like wood and, you know, sort of agricultural products and stuff like that you can burn, sometimes waste as well. The Natural Resource Defense Council would very much take issue with this being included. I think also that if we are cutting down trees in order to create energy, that doesn't seem super renewable to me. Another huge issue here, one that has been particularly relevant over the last decade, is nuclear energy. Nuclear is obviously a major source of carbon-free electricity. Since Fukushima Daiichi, you know, the disaster in Japan, it has not had a great publicist, which is a bit of an issue. And then there's also, you know, I'm indigenous. There's a very troubling history of what uranium mining has done to indigenous communities, the sort of pollution after effects, particularly for the Diné or the Navajo Nation in Arizona and New Mexico, the Havasupai and Yavapai in Arizona. And so it is, you know, it's a tough issue. Also, you know, you have things like hydropower, right? Which we don't really actually have that many more places where we could build hydropower in this country. And it is also a place where there are trade-offs between, you know, sort of climate goals and environmental issues.
Right. So like damming up a river is like not great. For the wildlife.
It's not great for the wildlife. I would also say that, you know, I have friends and relatives from Washington State where the salmon fishery is a big issue. Native nations have treaty rights to salmon there and are often very opposed to the dams because they disrupt the salmon habitat. So that's a major issue. But it also, you know, obviously can be a source of mostly carbon-free. When you actually build the dam, there's methane issues related to that. But mostly carbon-free electricity.
But in practice, right, like most of the promising hydro sites have already been built in the United States. But there is a big question about, like, we clearly could build more nuclear plants if we were so inclined, right? Like that technology works. It costs money and people don't like it necessarily, but like that's like a real policy option.
It is, yes. And there are some very vocal advocates for that. I think that I mean, this is one where I think that there are very strong arguments that I feel particularly personally close to because of the indigenous rights issues.
What is that? I apologize. I'm not particularly familiar with that. So this is the uranium mining is happening in indigenous areas.
Yeah. So uranium mining and nuclear testing also happened in near indigenous communities. It has had residual sort of impacts on water for a number of these communities, higher incidence of cancer.
Right.
You know, just not a very, the history of how we went about nuclear is not, I mean, there's a major reason why a lot of the environmental movement sort of in the 80s and 90s came out of a response to this.
Right.
And that's because it was bad stuff. But at the same time, you know, as we are facing a global sort of climate crisis, there are some strong arguments in favor of nuclear energy. You know, I the sort of the compromise position here that I think is probably worth putting out is sort of the German case, which is that sort of pressure to close nuclear plants actually meant that that electricity was substituted with LNG, natural gas.
Right.
And so actually the net impact on emissions was not super great. So I would say that the case for closing existing nuclear is not not fantastic because you might actually get replaced with natural gas, which is, you know, has methane emissions attached to it.
Right, it's not. I mean, we're at a margin now, right? Where the United States uses a lot of electricity. Relatively little of that comes from renewable sources. Mm-hmm. Renewables are growing. They could grow faster with more more investment. But also electricity demand is growing. And particularly if you electrify more and more of the transportation system, that's like you need more electricity, right? And so at a certain point, you could be at the margin of renewables substituting for nuclear. But like where we are now, it's like not clear that that's the case,
yeah.
Right? I mean, if you shut nuclear plants down now, what's going to happen is that natural gas plants run longer cycles.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So that's not great.
Yeah, it's not great.
So the other thing that's in this piece is carbon capture and sequestration, which I remember this was Biden's plan had pro CCS stuff in it that I think actually derived from one of these environmental labor sort of joint programs somewhere. I've heard very negative things about that from some environmental people. Like, what does that mean?
Carbon capture and sequestration. Yeah. So this is like popping a thing basically on top of the smokestack to ensure that the sort of emissions get the carbon gets captured. The issues on this one are sort of, so a lot of frontline and fence line communities, so people who live close to these plants, express significant concerns that there is a moral hazard here, that carbon capture and sequestration will prolong the life of industries that and fuel sources that need to sunset. Mm-hmm. So this is a major issue for the environmental justice movement. On the other hand, there is also a very strong argument that we need these kinds of technologies if we're going to be able to meet our emissions targets moving forward. So there's often sort of, we were just talking about clean and renewable energy. There's also often this conversation about net zero. Net mm-hmm. zero sometimes gets talked sort of tacked onto that. And this is basically the question of like sort of using carbon capture and sequestration to, you know, on maybe like a natural gas or something like that to make sure that we can actually meet the emissions targets, but we're still using some fossil fuel
right.
sources.
So like certain things, right, both like planting trees and some kind of hypothetical like carbon scrubbing mm-hmm. can actually take carbon out of the atmosphere, which could mean that there would be gross emissions, right? Like some natural gas plants are still running, but you're pulling enough carbon out. That's net zero.
Yeah.
People like to talk about these things, argue about them a lot.
And this is...
How big of a deal is it in practice? I'm always like a little confused sometimes by like what are we really talking about? I mean, it is true, right? In Germany, they actually did do big investments in renewable electricity, pair it with a nuclear phase out, and have not a big impact on emissions. So it's not a totally theoretical trade-off.
So there are places where this has been a very live debate in real life. So a year and a half ago, I was part of a coalition of activists who were lobbying about 45Q, which was a tax credit that was part of the big sort of Trump tax bill that would go to people who are utilizing carbon capture technologies. And we were concerned that that tax credit, there was one version of it that could be used for enhanced oil recovery. So we were concerned that so this is where you take the carbon that has been emitted, and then you actually use it to inject it back into sort of your drilling site to access more oil. So we were super concerned as, you know, left-leaning environmentalists that this is the way in which this would operate as effectively a subsidy. Subsequently, there has been some modeling that suggests that actually like 45Q is going to be helpful in sort of scaling carbon capture and sequestration technology that's going to be necessary to meet emissions targets. And so I personally actually don't know. And I think that this is, I wish that there were more advocates and like wonks who embrace this sort of perspective. But I actually don't think we're going to really fully know what the net impact of this tax credit is going to be until it actually sort of it happens in real time, right? And so I think that these debates matter about, are we arguing for 100% clean electricity or 100% renewable electricity, which would look actually quite different. And I don't want to sort of downplay the extent to which these forward-looking and sort of theoretical policy arguments are going to have real consequences about the way in which we go about this. But I also think that, as we approach these issues, there's going to be so many unforeseen technological developments. There's going to be, for any of these issues, there's all major siting questions, right? Like, where are you actually going to build this stuff? For nuclear, that's like one of the biggest issues. And so I think that, having a healthy sort of relationship about like the limits actually of our knowledge is super important. But then also leaning into just the basic reality that we do need to just be like going full speed ahead in terms of building out the stuff that we need. And I think sort of sorting through these issues as they arise.
All right, let's take another break and come back to some more of these questions.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Okay, so we've been talking, I think, mostly about electricity generation here, which is obviously an important part of climate change. But there is more sort of buckets to it. What does the Green New Deal mean for like people's commutes?
Hopefully, it means that we are going to build denser cities so more people can walk, more people can ride their bike, take public transportation. And hopefully, that means that you don't have to. I come from the Bay Area where commutes have suddenly become 2-hour affairs. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully it means that, in a Green New Deal future, you don't have to sit in your car and be angry for 2 hours a day about the fact that you're in bumper to bumper traffic.
But also some electric cars.
Some electric cars, of course, yes. And so it means there's going to be electric cars on the road. It means hopefully that in places like the Bay, we have more BART, more sort of zero emissions buses, more bike lanes, I think more smart and modern urban cities. I know this is like one of your favorite subjects.
I love cities. But this is the area where it's like the technology is fairly proven, right? I mean, bicycles work, subways work, even electric. You can't afford a Tesla, but like the cars work just fine. And we know how to do all that stuff. But then you get into some of these.
Well, there is one actually issue that's worth mentioning, which is that, if we build out these charging stations, they actually are only as green as the grid that they're attached to.
Right.
So it is important that we have decarbonize electricity at the same time as we're building out sort of the infrastructure for zero emissions transportation.
Right. But it's like electricity, daily transportation, it's like you can see it, right? Like right on the horizon, right? We have clean electricity. We don't have enough, but like it's there. We have green cars. We have mass transit. So we're just talking more, 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 more. But then you talk about like airplanes. Where I think there was some Green New Deal controversy, right? Because AOC wanted to ban airplanes or something like that. I mean, what do we do there? I mean, planes cause a lot of pollution.
I don't believe that AOC said she wanted to ban airplanes.
I'm not saying she said she did, but I definitely saw on Fox News that she said that.
Yeah, so this is one of the big issues, right, is that Republicans seized on a few sort of they seized on an FAQ and talked about cow farts and hamburgers and airplanes. So these are real issues. So there's an interesting it's from one of the sort of Nordic countries. I can't remember which one, but there's basically this proposal that you take 1.5% of GDP and invest it in R&D for things to address issues like aviation. And, you know, they think that can solve the issue. I think that also, you know, I mean, I'm going to be real. I think that like air travel for a significant fraction of this country has allowed middle class families to go and, you know, see some of the great cultures of the world. It allows kids to go study abroad. I got to go get a graduate diploma in the UK. And all that sort of stuff was enabled because of aviation. And so there's some real sort of complexity on this issue because it also is a major source of emissions. And I think this is one place where we are going to obviously have to sort of do much more research into what is possible without sort of jet fuel or maybe cleaner forms of jet fuel. But I think it's also a place where there might be a conversation about offsets, right?
Right. But I mean, so it's like, this is so, I mean, this is why politics is maddening, right? Because there's like so much we could do, right, in the relatively short term, particularly around electricity being greener, around transportation being greener, around like home insulation, which we haven't talked about, around home heating sources, right? Like this is all like fairly doable, but you would have to like do it, right? And there's intense political controversy. And then there are these important questions to be asked about like what is the long-term solution for air travel where we really don't know. But it's like when you raise
shipping,
that—
Shipping, also another really big one.
Right, yes. When you raise that question, like this has been seized on. There's a sign now in Michigan about how Gary Peters wants to ban steak. Conservatives understand that if you have the debate on those terms, right, about like, are there going to be airplanes and cows in the future, that that's a loser for progressives. So there's an impulse to be like, no, that's not what we're saying. But like air travel really does cause a lot of emissions.
Yeah. And air travel does cause emissions. I think a lot of academic sort of conferences are grappling with this, right? Like, is it ethical for them to be having these conferences where everyone has to get on a plane? I actually know some climate activists who will only fly once a year. So this is definitely a real issue. I just think that there are these issues that we're going to need to sort out. Aviation is a big one. Concrete production is another. Steel production, in some ways, agriculture also is a significant issue that we're going to have to sort through. But I think that yes, Republicans love to seize on these issues that we need to sort of sort through as sort of political batons with which they can beat their progressive adversaries. But, you know, I think that there are also a lot of ways in which, and this is, I think, what Data for Progress's sort of core role is for the progressive movement, there are ways that we can talk about these issues that enable our sort of elected officials, our movements, to put their best foot forward. And so I think we need to have, at the same time as yes, we need to have these very wonky, complicated debates and we need to learn more, to be mm-hmm. quite frank, about how we're going to approach some of these issues. I think there's also ways in which we can engage very effectively on political grounds with the opposition and win. I actually think that on climate change, the Democrats basically have a monopoly on credibility on mm-hmm. the issue. And I really like our odds, you know, taking on a conservative establishment that is deeply in the pockets of the fossil fuel industry and believes that global warming is a Chinese hoax. Like, I think that we actually can win on a lot of the issues if we take them on those grounds.
So, I mean, so what does that mean, though? Like, what grounds do you take them in on, right? I mean, if they are going to come back at you with like, you want to ban hamburgers, like what do you say? And do you have to tell the vegans to fuck off?
So I personally would not tell the vegans to fuck off. I work with a lot of vegans.
No, I'm sure you do.
You know, there's a lot of those.
We have a lot of militant vegans here at the Vox.com staff. There's a lot in the climate. No, but see, to me though, like this is part of what makes it politically challenging because like part of the to and fro is they'll be like, AOC wants to ban your hamburger. And then I'll be like writing an article that's like, actually, no, she doesn't. But then Ezra Klein, who I love, co-host of The Weeds, co-founder of Vox.com, has another good podcast. He'll come out with an article that's like, yeah, actually, we should ban hamburgers. It's not that helpful.
Yeah, well, so there's a lot to unpack here. So I think firstly, the messages that we see as winning on the Green New Deal and climate for Democrats are firstly the urgency and moral issue here, right? Like we need to give our children a livable climate. I think that that's number one. I think number two, the jobs and infrastructure messages, which are core, I would say, to the Green New Deal approach to climate policy, have proven to be quite effective. I would say also that a broader conversation, which the Green New Deal enables, not just about carbon emissions, but about other pollutants. So we want to talk about lead removal. We want to talk about clean air and clean water. I think that those are winning grounds for us and actually can be quite effective messages for folks across the United States. So in West Virginia, there was actually a race in which those messages were relevant among conservatives. And then lastly, I would say the conversation about, I think the conversation about justice is also a very important one. So I think making sure that we are talking about what this means for communities of color, what this means for indigenous nations, frontline communities, for workers, I think all of those messages are very powerful for us.
So frontline communities is a phrase I had not been familiar with until the rise of Green New Deal discourse. what does that mean?
So frontline communities are communities on the front lines of climate change. Yep. So they are they're the communities that are adjacent to polluting industries. So this is places like what's called Cancer Alley in Louisiana, which is sort of right on along the Mississippi River and is adjacent to a number of different sort of fossil fuel plants. This is communities like Standing Rock, where just a few years ago, there was obviously the very iconic campaign against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And this is also communities like the South Bronx, where there are very high levels of asthma because of sort of pollution in the air.
Yeah, I mean, Weeds listeners will know we've done a million studies about, particulate pollution and its impact on people, which is not, it's different from climate change, right? In that the CO2 emissions don't really care about your location, right? They go up into the atmosphere, the whole planet. I shouldn't say they don't care about your location. It matters how close you are to the coastline, but it doesn't matter how close you are to the source of the emissions, right? But particulates is different from that, right? If you live near a highway interchange, if you live near a coal plant, right, the impact on you is much, much more severe than it is on the typical person. And part of how we have dealt with those hazards historically is by sort of dumping the pollution on poor people.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is actually what the origin of the environmental justice movement. So the environmental justice movement is the sort of post-civil rights environmental movement that has been led by communities of color. And this is sort of one of the primary issues that they organized around. It was originally about sort of toxic waste sites and the fact that we were dumping all of our pollution in communities of color across the South, across the United States, and that this sort of became a way in which people of color actually came into the environmental movement was through that issue.
And so you mentioned lead also as part of this.
Yes, so places like Flint. So we've done a lot of public opinion surveys. They're available on our website. We also make our data available if any wonky people want to check it out. And so yes, lead removal is also a very popular issue. Also sort of, calls to attention the enduring sort of public health issues that are built into a lot of our infrastructure. So I'm sure some of your listeners will be familiar with sort of Flint and the water crisis there.
Yes, we have heard of that.
There's also
also in, I lived in New York for a number of years in New York City Housing Authority, public housing. There's significant lead removal issues there as well. And I think that, you know, while it's not just, while it's not directly about emissions, obviously, I think that addressing those kinds of public health and environmental health issues are really essential to the Green New Deal approach.
Right. So this is sort of a kind of broad question, but like, the biggest criticism that you hear is like, climate change is so hard. Why are you tackling on this other stuff?
Yeah, this is one of the biggest criticisms. And I think that the issue here is that like the way in which people experience climate change is actually not just through the parts per million in the atmosphere or the share of renewables on the grid. You know, the way in which people actually feel their climate change, actually experience climate change and energy policy is, you know, what they pay in their energy bill. It's the quality of their neighborhood. It's the jobs that they have access to. And so I think if we want to build a winning coalition and actually create political durability to climate policy, I think we need to sort of address those sorts of issues that are sort of part of the whole picture of sort of the fossil fuel economy and sort of environmental injustice issues.
All right. So before I let you go, one last thing. What should I have asked you about? What did we miss here?
Yeah. So I think that one thing that we missed is the sort of issues of diversity in the environmental movement that I think are really core to the politics. So very briefly, the environmental movement emerged out of a set of thinkers who sort of ranged from garden variety racists to eugenicists. And the institutions that they built and the policies that they pushed for really reflected this. So the best example are the national parks, which are so-called America's best idea, which actually were often built at the exclusion of indigenous communities who were living there, communities of color, working class folks who were accessing those lands. And so I think that that sort of history of exclusion and just sort of soft racism has played a major role in which the environmental movement has developed in this country. It has been a much more sort of white social movement than some of the other ones that we might think about, notably civil rights.
And there have been ties. I mean, you mentioned national parks, but also ties between early environmentalists and sort of third world coercive population control ideas, anti-immigration ideas. So this is sort of like multiple legacies of connection between the origins of the environmental movement and serious racial exclusion.
Yeah, serious issues. I mean, there's one eugenicist author who's like sort of cited by Richard Spencer types and who Hitler liked to read. I mean, this is a real part of the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's been since at least the civil rights movement nationally, there's been a push for greater diversity, for greater interest in the ways in which pollution disproportionately impact communities of color. And I think that I think that the Green New Deal has succeeded clearly in building a multi-generational sort of environmental and climate movement. Obviously, the folks who we see pushing for this most often are young people. But we also need, I would say, people of color to be more engaged in this coalition. And I think that building sort of that next generation of the environmental movement through a Green New Deal is one of the things that gets me really excited every day.
All right. Fantastic. So thank you so much, Julian Noisecat. Thanks to our producer, Jeffrey Guild, and to Malachi Brodus for working as our engineer on this episode. And The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.